Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on best practices in judgment enforcement. Obtaining a judgment for an unpaid debt is an important step in the recovery process, but locating and recovering assets and actually sort of recovering those debts after a judgment has been obtained is just as critical. In this webinar, which is being produced in conjunction with the Florida Collectors Association, we have noted attorney Stephen Iglesias with us to walk through the post-judgment enforcement process and provide tips and best practices in this important area of collections. As I mentioned, this webinar is being generously sponsored by the Florida Collectors Association, and we thank them for their support. Let me tell you a little bit about today's speaker. Stephen Iglesias is an attorney in Tampa, representing creditors in courts throughout Florida in commercial and consumer debt collections, with a practice emphasis on healthcare reimbursement. Stephen's practice includes all aspects of legal collections, including post-judgment enforcement, garnishment, and collateral recovery. Prior to entering into private practice, Stephen served as an assistant attorney general in the Florida Attorney General's Economic Crimes Division and Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. For Medicaid fraud cases brought in Central Florida, Stephen was lead counsel in asset seizure and forfeiture efforts. He has more than 20 years of experience in state and federal court litigation. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan, go blue, Columbia University in New York, and Southern Methodist University. The format for today's webinar will be a presentation from Stephen. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we will get to them when the presentation has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Before I bring Stephen on, I wanted to give Matt Kiefer, president of the Florida Collectors Association, a moment to say a few words. Matt?
Hi, guys. Sorry I'm late to the call. I just want to really appreciate Stephen for taking this opportunity to present this seminar, his second one with us, and for Florida Collectors Association. And Mike, Gibb, you just do a tremendous job in your accountsrecovery.net and your daily emails. I don't know where you find the time to do all that, but we really appreciate it. And I just want to just say a shout out to our FCA members on the calls and others that might be on the call that do business in Florida. Please, if you're not a member of the Florida Collectors Association and you'd like to join, please reach out to us. We'd love to have you.
Awesome. Excellent. Thanks again, Matt. And thanks again to the Florida Collectors Association for partnering with me on this webinar and hopefully many more webinars to come. Stephen, with that, we're ready to hand the microphone over to you to begin our presentation. You ready?
I'm ready. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Stephen, real quick. Yep. Stephen, real quick. I'm sorry. I hate to interrupt. Guys, I'm going to have to run and jump off the call, but I really appreciate you all doing this and enjoy. Thanks.
Okay. No problem. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, so you have won your trial, or the debtor has been sued but has defaulted or has consented to a judgment. We're going to talk about the steps and processes that go on after that to hopefully collect, and you'll talk about some of the just the practice points I've picked up doing this for a long time. Go to the next page. Just up front, usual disclaimer, this is just legal education and it doesn't constitute legal advice. Next page. Judgment lien components, and all of us on the call likely know what a judgment looks like. It's a document, court document signed by the judge, with the case style, case number, that will say final judgment on top and essentially say that the debtor owes the creditor a certain principal amount of money, may or may not be pre-judgment interest depending on the contract, attorney fees, and court costs. The state of Florida does award statutory interest, and that's not discretionary. That's set forth by statute, and the rate changes four times a year. These are parts of a judgment lien that I have seen missed. And understand that making a mistake or having an error in a judgment lien is not fatal. The creditor can go back to the judge and ask for the error to be modified. However, that takes time and there are costs. The clerk of the court will want to charge a case reopening fee, and you're going to have to re-record the judgment. And that also muddles up the public records too. So instead of having the judgment recorded twice, you'll have two that are incorrect, and then you'll have a modified judgment. So here are three bullet points of items that I've seen that have caused problems. The judgment creditor's address needs to be stated. So even if an attorney is assisting the creditor and has assisted the creditor with the case, having the attorney's address alone isn't enough. You're going to want to put the judgment creditor's address. For debt buyers, that's typically going to be a lockbox, a P.O. box of some sort. But that's one item you want to have in there. The next is a relatively newer requirement, but if the judgment debtor's social security number and last known address is known, the last four digits should be identified in the judgment. And what I do when I don't know the social security number is I will put a parenthetical in the judgment that says SSN unknown or some sort of similar language. I've seen judgments that try to substitute a date of birth for social security, the last four digits of a social security number, and that isn't contemplated in the statute. So there isn't any requirement to put a date of birth, nor does a date of birth serve as a substitute for a social security number. And again, we want to put the last known address of the judgment debtor in the judgment. And the third is to include all possible debtor names in the judgment. This came up in my practice recently where we had a judgment against in a commercial claim, but the defendant was listed not as the corporate name, it was listed as the trade name. So, in trying to enforce a judgment like that where we're looking to bank accounts or other sorts of property, we're going to want to make sure that the corporate name, whatever that may be, Acme Construction LLC, and not just the trade name. What the best practice is to, when suit is initiated, to include all possible names into the suit as a defendant. So trade names, DBAs, formerly known as maiden names with or without a middle name. And that way, every possible iteration is covered. Next page. A judgment in of itself is not a lien attachable against personal or real property. So similar to a judgment doesn't automatically compel a debtor to pay, the creditor needs to go out and exercise and use the various legal tools available to collect. A judgment in of itself is not a lien against personal property. And this is a frequent point of confusion, because what happens when a judgment is entered, it will be entered into official records in the county where the judgment was entered, which intuitively would make one think that in of itself means the judgment's recorded and that's a lien. But actually, there's an additional process, a two-step process. One is to file a motion, not with the judge, but it's to file a motion with the clerk of the court to re-record the judgment in official records as a judgment lien. So when you file your motion, you're going to have a page number from the original judgment that's already been recorded. So you'll want to reference that. But you have to re-record that judgment in order for it to become a lien on any real property owned by the debtor. This may result in the judgment lien appearing twice in official records, which is okay, but that's the way our system works here. And to have a lien recorded against personal property, that lien needs to be filed with the Florida Department of State, and that can be done online. So that would be your lien against any kind of personal property, vehicles, boats, etc. The lien that's recorded in the county only applies to real estate. Next page. Once the judgment is obtained, the creditor needs to discover assets that it can levy upon to collect. And there are a variety of different formal and informal tools that are used to gather information. The one that is most common is what is called the fact information sheet. That is a form that exists under what are called the Florida Rules of Civil Procedure. Those are the rules of court procedure. It's essentially a court-approved form, which requires the debtor to provide various forms of financial information, tax returns, bank records, identify whether the debtor is or is not employed. There's a spousal information section on a fact information sheet. The idea is for, you know, once a creditor gets a judgment, that there are some processes that automatically go into effect that allow the creditor to execute on that. And what will typically happen is in the judgment itself, the judge will sign off on a requirement that the debtor must complete a fact information sheet and provide all the necessary financial attachments. And typically that's done within 30 days of the date of execution. The debtor would provide the documentation to both the creditor or the creditor's attorney, and also file a redacted copy with the clerk of the court. If a debtor fails to complete a fact information sheet, the requirement in the judgment is enforceable through what is called contempt action. So the creditor can go back to the judge and say, and ask to hold the debtor in what is called contempt of court to compel or require the debtor to complete the fact information sheet. There are various levels of contempt. Usually, judges will give the debtor multiple chances to complete the form. Typically, the excuses or reasons given for not completing the form are, I didn't receive it, I forgot about it. And the judges will provide, you know, 2-3 chances to allow the debtor to complete it. And then ultimately, if it's not completed, there's an arrest order entered, and you know the debtor is finally taken into custody, and the purge, or the requirement to get out of custody or out of jail, is to complete the fact information sheet. Judges hate executing arrest orders. The sheriffs don't like taking debtors into custody for fact information sheet issues. So that's why, it could sometimes take many months to get one of these finally completed. The second is a traditional deposition, the kind that a creditor or a creditor's attorney would take in the pretrial phase. You subpoena the debtor to appear before a court reporter and to bring documents requested, typically the same sort you would see in a fact information sheet, but the debtor shows up before a court reporter at a court reporter's office, typically, or at the law firm, and testifies under oath. And the examination would traditionally last, you know, at least an hour, and we would go through orally just an entire line of questions about the debtor's financial situation and employment situation. UCC filings are another source of a place to go search for property. Florida Department of Motor Vehicles, except you always have to check the lien status on a vehicle. You know, when I was a prosecutor, our law enforcement folks always wanted us to, you know, seize vehicles, but if there's a lien on the vehicle, that lien needs to get satisfied first. So unless that vehicle is free and clear, that isn't something, you know, the creditor would want to get involved with. The Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulations, liquor licenses, creditors can levy on liquor licenses. I could create a whole separate presentation on the various types of liquor licenses and the process that goes into that, but there is a process for creditors executing on a liquor license. The Florida Department of State, the creditor is going to want to look at whether, in a commercial case, is the debtor, for instance, a multiple member LLC or a single member LLC. In the case where the debtor, your commercial debtor, is a single member LLC, the Florida Supreme Court says that single member LLC effectively functions as a pass-through for creditor for judgment enforcement purposes to the individual owner. So single member LLCs, you know, typically a person who's a sole practitioner, a single consultant, that's going to offer very minimal asset protection to the judgment debtor. Next page. Some of the non-traditional forms of discovery are the use of asset search and private investigators. Up front, I say you need to use caution when using asset search firms and private investigators. You have to make sure that they are FDCPA compliant, or at least when you enter into your vendor agreement, that there is indemnification if the outside firm or private investigator is not compliant. They're expensive. Some are better than others. They're sometimes useful in identifying, for instance, current employers. Additional sources of information. I have financial affidavits from divorce proceedings. Those are maybe public records and accessible just by going down to the courthouse. That's not something that's going to be available online. That's something, you know, that you're going to have to take a, you know, make a special trip to take a look at. If there is a recent mortgage that the debtor has obtained, let's say within the past 6 months, sending a third-party subpoena to the lender for a copy of the loan application is helpful. You know, a debtor may, you know, be very abbreviated in filling out a fact information sheet, but when someone is applying for a loan and they want that loan, those require obviously a lot of detailed financial information, and the debtor may be a lot more forthcoming on a loan application than in a fact information sheet. Next page. Homestead. This is an issue that comes up frequently, obviously, with in consumer debt cases. You've got your judgment, and you've recorded it. It's been re-recorded as a judgment lien. Now what? most property ownership in your typical consumer case is going to be homesteaded. Your judgment lien is not going to allow the creditor to force a sale of a property that is subject to homestead protection. I mean, the exception would be obviously a secured lien, a mortgage, or for instance, or homeowners association. But in your typical, you know, unsecured debt claim, which results in a judgment lien, you have a lien against the property, but you can't force a judgment sale. So essentially, the judgment lien remains intact against the homesteaded property, but you literally have to wait until either the property is sold or refinanced. And at that time, in order to clear title, the judgment lien must be satisfied. Judgments are valid for 20 years after the date of execution. I have had title companies call me, you know, many years after cases that have been settled for a long time, and you know, suddenly, you know, hear from a title company and they want to know how to clear the title out and clear the lien up. So it's a bit of a wait and see. And there are also technology solutions that would allow a creditor to monitor property sales. Next page. Wage and bank garnishments. Garnishments are the most common form of tool that is most commonly used to execute judgments. I would say out of the cases I have, 90%+ of the post-judgment enforcement work that I do and other collection attorneys do involves some sort of wage or bank garnishment. And the reason is, there are many reasons for that. First of all, it's very cost effective. There aren't any sheriff's fees. There are no bonding requirements that the creditor go out and post a bond. Like would be necessary if one wanted to go levy on a vehicle or a boat. You know, you don't have to go out and rent a storage warehouse. It's cost effective. Wage garnishments are what are called continuing, meaning that once the writ of garnishment is served, and ultimately the judge enters a final order of garnishment, the garnishment continues from the date of the writ of garnishment is served, through the entire term of employment, or whenever the judgment is satisfied, whichever is earlier, obviously. Next page.
Sure. While I'm doing that, we did get a question come in, Stephen. So let me ask that and use this as a reminder to everybody. If you have a question for Stephen, please enter it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel, and we'll get to it before the end of the session. The question is, do you believe the lien affected by recording the judgment is still valid after the judgment expires? Should a title company call for a payoff?
You mean after 20 years? I mean, the judgment is no longer, the judgment and lien are extinguished after 20 years.
I don't have more information.
That judgment can be renewed prior to the 20 years expiring. The most prudent course of action would be for the creditor to seek a renewal of the judgment lien for another 20 years. So that is going to be more prudent than, you know, relying on a title company perceiving the lien as valid after the expiration of the 20-year term.
We did get a clarification. So the judgment is expired if not renewed, but is the lien also extinguished?
Well, if the judgment has expired, the lien will go away with it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Wage garnishments. The rule is you can garnish no more than 25% of the debtor's income if their weekly disposable income exceeds 30 times the federal minimum wage. And if their weekly disposable income is less than 30 times the federal minimum wage, their income cannot be garnished at all. And finally, the what is garnishable are disposable earnings. So it's compensation after withholding, essentially. And when the garnishee or the employer files an answer, in the answer, the garnishee will, lay out what the gross compensation is on a biweekly basis, typically, and identify all the withholding. So, next page. And here's how this plays out in real life. Federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. $7.25 times 30 hours is $217.50. So if the debtor's take-home pay after taxes and deductions is less than $217.50 a week, you can't garnish their wages. If it's more, you can. So it's a relatively minimal threshold. Next page. Bank garnishments are different than wage garnishments in that they are not continuing. They function in a snapshot of time. So when the garnishment is served on the bank, the bank will freeze the account as of that moment of time. This creates timing issues, especially in commercial claims, with the account fluctuating with funds very frequently. Friday is typically payroll day, so on that date, serving a bank garnishment on a Friday typically is not a great idea. There's a lot of luck of the draw with bank garnishments that don't really apply with wage garnishments. If the debtor claims exemption from garnishment as head of household, the debtor has the burden to prove the bank account proceeds are earnings or other exempt assets. So we'll talk about head of household in a second, but the debtor has the burden of proving, for instance, coming into court and saying, Judge, I received direct deposit from my employer into this bank account. Here's a copy of my pay stub and a recent account statement from my bank. I've seen cases where debtors have tried to claim bank account exemptions on business accounts or accounts that are just unrelated completely to earnings. So usually the question, do you receive a direct deposit at this bank, is par for the course in an exemption hearing. Next page. So there are lots of exemptions to garnishment. The debtors have several rights. The one that is most commonly asserted is head of household. In that, the debtor is claiming he provides more than one half of the support for a child or other dependent. And that's a very fact-specific analysis. So in a claim of exemption hearing where the debtor has had a household, the debtor is going to have to show that the earnings the debtor brings in provide for more than half of the household support. So and that's a mathematical calculation, highly fact specific. Earnings, household, and dependent are not identified under the garnishment statute, which gives judges very wide latitude to determine whether the exemption applies. There are certain judges. Some judges will be very detail oriented and requiring some mathematical certainty on the part of the debtor in showing that they are head of household. Some just don't, and it's really specific in that regard. Earnings are typically the fruits of one's labor in an arm's length relationship with employers. So earnings are not going to apply to independent contractors, solo practitioners, income that's not 1099 focused. So even though there is not a definition of household, what we look for in the claim of exemption hearing on the creditor side is there a communal living situation? Is there a legal duty to maintain minor children or a spouse? So, for example, one common head of household argument that are sometimes made by debtors are, you know, support of a child in college that lives away from home, off camp, in a campus apartment, for instance, or in a dormitory. I've seen judges that have found that to both qualify as dependency, and judges that have gone the other direction. There aren't any court cases specifically on that topic. I had a case last week where the judge said, no, that's not a communal living situation where a child is living away. And, the child may have student loans and files an individual tax return, et cetera. It also comes up where, you know, there may be adult parents, elderly parents that may be living in the household, other family members, aunts, uncles, cousins, and does that family situation qualify as a dependency situation? And the question is whether the debtor has a legal obligation to support that family member. You know, debtors have legal obligations to support their children and their spouses. Once the family circle starts expanding, it gets more questionable. In a line of inquiry in determining how to household, we'll ask about spousal income and all additional income streams. So that could be life insurance proceeds, it could be inheritance, it could be rent, lottery winnings, any income stream that you can think about. And you really have to go through all of them, because unless you specifically ask, the debtor will say, no, I just make my income through wages. So you have to just, you know, literally go through lottery rental income, go through the whole list. Again, we talked about this, is the minor child declared as a dependent on the tax return? So that's going to be an important question in cases where, there's a divorce, the child is going between two homes. The child can't be declared a dependent on both parents' tax returns. So it's either one or the other. So that's an important information to ask. In the event of a bank garnishment, even if the debtor does prove the head of household exemption, only 6 months of earnings may be shielded. So it's going to be important in a bank garnishment case to make sure that you've got a good year's worth of bank statements to support the debtor's claim. So if the debtor doesn't show up to court with supporting bank statements, a year's worth of bank statements, I'll typically ask the judge to either continue the case or deny the claim outright. Next page.
Sure. We also got another question that came in asking if these rules are all specific to Florida, or do they apply to other states such as Texas?
Okay, and I apologize. Yeah, I just opened up the question bar. No, this is Florida specific. And not only is it Florida specific, this is Florida state claim specific. So this presentation doesn't contemplate a court order from a federal court. This is contemplating a state county court or circuit court action. let me see. Okay, I think I've answered all of them at this point. There are other exemptions to garnishments, and with regard particularly to a bank garnishment, if the debtor claims the account is exempt because it is held in what is called tenancy by the entireties, and I probably should have put that in quotes, that account may be exempt from garnishment. Bank of America in particular will state on the account whether it is or is not an account held by tenancy on the entireties. Not every bank does that, but BOA does. Of course, you cannot garnish government benefits such as Social Security, veterans benefits, SSI, you know, anything like that, retirement and pension. Those funds are exempt. They cannot be garnished. Workers' comp, of course, any public assistance, that makes sense. And college savings, including the Florida prepaid plan or 503B plans. Again, it's going to be the burden on the judgment debtor to prove entitlement. So the debtor comes in and says, my bank account contains a mix of wages, Social Security benefits, and pension. The debtor has the burden to parse those amounts out and should have some supporting documentation to parse that information out. Next page. Proceeding supplementary. So this would be considered an advanced collection technique and only used for higher balances, judgments where we think the debtor has moved money around, has engaged in what we call fraudulent transfers to try to evade creditors. And what proceeding supplementary allow you to do, it allows you to bring post-judgment, essentially to bring a lawsuit within a lawsuit. It allows a judgment creditor to pursue the property of the judgment creditor in the custody of third parties in the same case from which that judgment arose. So in a consumer case, typically it's a spouse. The debtor will move the money to an account in the spouse's name only, move the money into a commercial account, into a child's account, will engage in a variety of overlaying transactions to hide assets or engage in fraudulent transfers. And what proceeding supplementary allow creditors to do, it lays out a very highly specific procedure in both Florida law and Florida civil procedure, which allow the creditor to essentially reopen the case, bring the matter before the judge who heard the underlying case, and essentially bring a lawsuit against a third party, that third party spouse, or that third party friend, or business. And the nice thing about it is the creditor doesn't have to file a separate lawsuit, pay a separate filing fee, and essentially start from scratch. You're essentially 75% of the way done. And in proceeding supplementary, the creditor can obtain judgments just like they would get in a new lawsuit. The creditor's right to initiate proceeding supplementary is mandatory, meaning it's not something that the judge, you're going to have a hearing before the judge on as to whether it's meritorious for the creditor to move forward or not. It's a mandatory procedure. The judge technically does not have any discretion. There are reasonable attorney fees and costs are taxed against the adjudgment debtor, but not against the impleader defendant. Who is the impleader defendant? The impleader defendant is that third party that we're talking about. So assuming you think you have a viable creditor, you can tax reasonable attorney fees, and costs, even though in the underlying case, there may not have been, let's say, a contractual provision that would have allowed the creditor to collect attorney fees. Reasonable attorney fees are statutory, what are called statutory and mandatory and proceeding supplementary. The impleaded third party has a right to a jury trial. In your underlying case, you may not have had a jury trial, you may have had a bench trial, particularly if it's in a small claim or county court matter under $15,000. And the next page. There is an entire presentation that I could do on pre-judgment or pre-suit execution strategies. Before a lawsuit is filed, there are in certain cases, garnishments and what are called replevins or repossessions are contemplated under Florida law. Those are used, for instance, in cases where we're concerned that if the debtor knew that there was a what's called a replevin action is being filed, that the debtor would try to hide the property. So think of an automobile case, for instance, or an equipment recovery case where the equipment is easily movable. So, you know, perhaps I'll come back and talk about pre-suit and pre-judgment. But at this point, I'll take any further questions.
We'll give people a chance to queue or type in their questions if they have any. One of the questions I had for you, going back to something you were saying earlier, with respect to, you know, the documents and sort of filling out the names, and you were talking about maiden names and formerly known as, is there like a limit to sort of, you know, how many names you can put on there, or is it always sort of more is better?
So you, I mean, each defendant you list, is going to will be technically a separate party and generate a separate clerk's case filing fee. But you can list as many DBAs and trade names and formerly known as and maiden names. You can list as many alternative names as you want. So if you look at, you know, in a foreclosure case, typically, they'll list the name of the borrower and, you know, any known or unknown spouses. You know, a foreclosure pleading, when they list a defendant, it'll be many lines long, but it's just one defendant, one filing fee. So.
Got it. Well, there's a question that just came in. Here we go. Do you or your office handle post-judgment collections from other states than Florida?
Yeah, so I think what the questioner is referring to is what we call domesticating foreign judgments. The answer is yes. So what domesticating foreign judgments means is, let's say we have a judgment from a state court in New York. There is a process under Florida law and every other state, it's not unique to Florida, to take that New York judgment, domesticate it in Florida, and execute on it as if it is a Florida judgment. That's, you would do that in the case where your New York debtor has relocated to Florida, for instance, and there's property located in Florida that one would want to levy upon. So the answer to that question is yes.
Great. Well, I don't see any other questions right now. Maybe as a means of sort of wrapping up, is there any other do you have any sort of concluding remarks, a summary of everything you've gone over today, which is really comprehensive, or you know, any other sort of key takeaways that you want to leave people with as they head out to tackle this on their own?
Yeah, and I think the key takeaway, if I could, if you remember one word from this presentation, it's, or maybe two words, it's accuracy and detail. They're you know, typically in, you know, in some of the higher volume firms, for instance, details are missed, and the problem is those details they have to go back and get fixed at a later date. So try to get it right the first time. pay attention to detail up front and be accurate in how you proceed.
Well, excellent. Well, Stephen, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing this great amount of information. I really appreciate it. And on behalf of everybody who participated and who's here watching and listening, thank you. This was an awesome job. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, thanks, everybody. Again, thanks to the Florida Collectors Association for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate everybody's participation and continued support. Hope everyone has a great weekend and stays tuned to AccountsRecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Hope everyone enjoys the rest of your day and your weekend. Thanks again. Take care.